Chapter 11. Who Killed Mum? Almost 83 years old, but unlikely to get there, Mum lies on her deathbed, inert, save for that terrible, hard breathing. She's been back and forth to the hospital like a city bus, but now comes the terminus. Mum is dying. Perhaps it is time to start the blame game. Surely, someone must be responsible. Recently, a friend of mine talked about her father's death. "It helps to have somewhere to focus your anger," she said. "And where is hers targeted?" I asked. "On Dad's wife," my friend said firmly. "She didn't want him to go on living." Pretty harsh. "And how old was Dad?" 95, she said. "But his own dad lived to be 97. There's not much you can say about natural causes. That's why few celebrities ever die of them. Not many famous cases end with the official coroner's report. Several historians claim Napoleon was poisoned. Princess Diana was murdered, according to Mohammed Al-Fayed. Nirvana lead singer Kurt Cobain, a notorious depressive and veteran of suicide attempts, was found with a shotgun and a suicide note. His widow hired a private investigator. The detective's verdict? Murder. Marilyn Monroe was purportedly killed by the Kennedys, who were in turn killed by the CIA and the Mafia and Fidel Castro. Michael Jackson could not be allowed to live. He knew too much. And what do we really know about who shot Bambi's mum? Generally speaking, important people do not simply expire. So it seems only right to afford the same status to my mother. She's important too. Someone must be killing her. There are solid suspects. Grandma's role in the crime has been examined. Medical malpractice has played its part. But there are others in the perp lineup. Surely her husband took years off her life. That can't be helped. Then there are the children. None had motive, but all had opportunity and time to make it look like natural causes. Damning evidence is easy to find. The mere fact of our arrival in a 6-year span would have been enough to kill some women, never mind raising, corralling, chasing, and trying to keep us above ground despite a veritable medical catalog of illnesses and a litany of accidents showing astonishing creativity. On the disease front, I ran the usual gamut of measles, mumps, chickenpox, and bronchitis, but also went the extra mile by picking up scarlet fever. Who knows how many days the stress subtracted from Mum's lifespan? Joe spent some time in a cult. Lynn was a hellcat capable of such venom that Mum wept and truly came to believe her daughter despised her. Jock frequently made our house the center of a social circle that, while sparkling, could have resulted in charges of aiding and abetting the corruption of minors. Leslie added more of the same. Yet these are mild diversions, a lifeless pile of pale pink herrings. You want the real suspect, the one who stands hands dripping red at the end of a long litter trail of circumstantial evidence. Who do you like for this murder? I'm your man. I don't know if I really shortened poor Mum's life. The fact is that she surely lived a lot longer than most medical people expected. Perhaps she really was too tough to be killed off by the likes of us. But I think it's fair to say I contributed more stress to her life than any immediate relative except her own mother. The sordid chronicle of my adolescence will make it clear what my mother was forced to deal with. But first, a small sample. The story of an early morning bicycle ride. I was probably about 18 years old, still living in the basement, the only child left at home. I'd been at an all-night party, and as morning dawned, I stumbled out to my bike to ride home. I remember only little snapshots from that ride, but they are enough to confirm that I made the entire crosstown ride while looking straight down at the ground. Stop signs ambled through the corner of my eye as I trundled on blindly, spared from death or injury by dumb luck and the fact that I lived in a town small enough for the streets to be deserted very early on a Sunday morning. A witness supplied the end of the story. I wasn't really there. The sun was already up, and kids were playing on the street, when my mother saw me pedal into the driveway and stop. Not stop and dismount, but simply stop pedaling, pausing upright for a wondrous moment before toppling over, bike and all, like a tipped cow. With a crowd of kids pointing and laughing, Mum had to walk out to the driveway and drag me into the house. In fitting punctuation to a perfect experience of pain for her and humiliation for me, I had pissed myself. This was just a random morning. Not the beginning of the problem, nor the end. Not a trivial incident, but not the worst either. Only a snapshot of the sadness, stress, and anxiety I inflicted on my mother, a woman with 4 other kids and a full-time job. Maybe it wasn't murder exactly, but what I put her through was certainly criminal. I was a good kid once. People liked me. I was cute. My brothers and sisters called me Chicken Hawk, after the determined little character from Bugs Bunny cartoons, because of my adorably pudgy little cheeks. My 11th birthday was less than 2 weeks after Woodstock. It was an exciting time. Unless you were 11 and living in Brandon. The local radio station played Perry Como and Al Martino and Bobby Sherman. I had no idea who James Brown was. All that counterculture excitement seemed to be happening on a distant world to lucky older people. People who took drugs. Some kids find purpose and constructive fun in athletics and clubs. It's not as though I didn't try. I just sucked at it. For me, the only truth to be found in physical activity was this. Young males achieve social dominance through mastery of the very skills I lacked. Jock used to reminisce about witnessing the highlight of my Little League career, a very loud, foul ball. As for manly prowess, I was the only kid in my Cub Scout troop with a naked sleeve, empty of stars and merit badges. It is my contention that this reflected a subtle rejection of authority rather than simple ineptitude, although I had ineptitude as well. 1 year, my woodshop teacher presented me with a plaque adorned with a question mark and the inscription, Royal Order of Wood Butchers. True story. Neither athlete nor craftsman, I was nevertheless a precocious lad, pretentious even if that taunt can be thrown at anyone so callow. At age 13, I declared myself to be a communist. Probably the best time of life to flirt with communism. I was determined to demonstrate an ability to keep up with my elders. Sharing the house with older brothers and sisters who were already getting into high school-level misbehavior, I wanted in. In particular, I longed to join in with Jock and his friends. 3 years older, Jock was part of a remarkable circle. They were, in my eyes, a young Renaissance group. Even now, those teenagers live on in my memory as paragons of vibrant creativity and preternatural sophistication, permanently enshrined as an ideal I will never match. Our basement was the center of their social activity. They drank, but were not drunkards by Manitoba standards, and their gatherings seemed to me more like salons than teenage booze-ups. Once they organized a square dance, pushed the furniture to one side, and swung around to bluegrass music. We had an old, out-of-tune piano down there that nobody in our family could play, but Jock's friend Fat, who wasn't, was a music student. One late night, Dad came storming down the stairs to break up a noisy party and ended up sitting on the stairs, tapping his feet, while Fat banged out melodies. There were plenty of influences to corrupt a young mind in those days. Drugs were an integral part of the scene for a questing young person of the early 70s. Being a worldly youngster involved delving into the books of Carlos Castaneda, who told of other dimensions accessible through powerful Mexican substances. Happily, this drug mystique did not extend to anything hard. Our crowd had no romantic illusions about heroin, and cocaine wasn't really available. Hallucinogens were the big attraction, along with marijuana and hashish. I was eager to get in on it all. Since Jock was already of an age when such experimentation came naturally, I only had to stay close to get a head start. December 1971, Christmas break. I was 13, a grade 8 student. Jock, his best friend Mike, and I pooled our meager funds and sent Jock down to the pool hall. His mission? To buy some pot, something we had yet to try. Jock came back a couple of hours later. I couldn't find any pot, he said, but I got these. In his hand were several little packets. It was LSD, a variety the seller had described as purple microdot. We took them. I still don't know if that was the best LSD ever, or whether the effect was just amplified by my youth and inexperience, but it was certainly overwhelming. We put on an appropriate record, Pink Floyd's Umma Gumma, and waited for the stuff to kick in. It didn't really hit till partway through King Crimson's Lizard. Then, liftoff. None of us could talk for a while, a function of brains racing with inexpressible thoughts. Stupid and nonsensical thoughts, most likely, but understood at the time as profundities too awe-inspiring for mere speech. I recall constantly brushing at some sort of red bead curtain that seemed to hang in front of me. At one point, I had the sudden conviction that my arm was going to eat my head. It's hard to recommend LSD as an alternative to summer camp, but it seems to me now just another part of my adolescence, alongside more prosaic activities like playing sports or watching TV. It isn't heroin or crack. Those relentless hobbies will turn you into a frantic mother bird with a nest full of gaping mouths. LSD and other hallucinogens, my brother and I would eventually try a few, were more like a series of self-contained experiences that picked you up and dropped you off about 8 hours later, sated. At about $5 a pop, once every 3 or 6 months, LSD did not require any of us to steal TV sets. Nor was it the end of childhood innocence, or the beginning of a jaded and premature adulthood. It was an artificially induced experience of wonder. My use of hallucinogens ran its course by the time I was 17. It would have ended one hit sooner, but one night at a party, some acid-happy friends stuck half a tab into a Pop-Tart and fed it to me. They did have the decency to explain the situation immediately. With about 8 or 9 beers under my belt, I didn't believe their story, until in a remarkable demonstration of the drug's power, the drunkenness slid away, as if the LSD had simply taken me by the collar and lifted me above the fog. It would be my final trip, and my final Pop-Tart. Later I would learn firsthand that any kind of contraband drug use carried dangers. You never really knew what you were buying. On at least 2 occasions, my attempts to buy powdered mescaline led me to something that turned out to be, in all likelihood, PCP, also known as angel dust, a substance whose one-time popularity remains an enduring mystery to me. We used to call it horse tranquilizer. Consuming it was always an accident, like getting food poisoning at a restaurant. PCP produced a feeling rather like being drunk and sober simultaneously, stupid, slow, and sloppy, yet without the blissful oblivion of alcoholic intoxication. You remained perfectly aware of your disgusting condition. It's horrible stuff, sold in the guise of various other products. Powder in tinfoil looks like powder. There's not much quality control in the street drug business. Mum and Dad would not have agreed with my assessment of LSD's relative harmlessness. Although they did not find out about the acid dropping until many years later, there was one near miss. A friend and I dropped some acid one Saturday, expecting it to run its course by dinner time. Whether because we started too late, or because the dose in question proved too powerful, we miscalculated. And so I found myself sitting at the family dinner table while still firmly planted in Strangeville. It's a nightmarish scenario for any young acid head. As countless hipster films have suggested, the everyday world of the North American family dinner becomes a surreal and somewhat horrifying experience when one is under the effects of LSD. The quotidian seems absurd, and in the complete absence of hunger, acid works on the appetite in a way almost exactly opposite of marijuana, food can appear both ludicrous and vile, stifling the urge to laugh at amusements no one else will perceive as a struggle. Worst of all is the paranoia that results from the complete inability to judge the suitability of your own behavior. Then, once your odd demeanor has attracted suspicion, your saucer-like dilated pupils are there to confirm it. The real giveaway was the cutlery. I couldn't manage it. Throughout dinner, I repeatedly threw down my knife and fork with loud sighs of frustration. "May I be excused?" I barked. In the resulting silence, I scurried down the stairs. Not cool. My parents came downstairs and went into the basement den. They almost never did that. I headed up the stairs, making for the back door and freedom. Too late. "Steve," Dad's voice intoned, "can we speak to you for a minute?" My parents, I felt sure, were not well-versed in drug culture. They'd have read scary stories in newspapers and Newsweek magazine, certainly. But even if Dad read that Timothy Leary book his psychiatrist gave him, I don't think he really grasped the pharmaceutical foundations of those psychedelic prayers. I needed a story. Something plausible that would take the heat off. There had been occasions recently when Leslie's friends had popped wake-up pills, over-the-counter amphetamines for a cheap buzz. I decided to offer that up as my explanation. They bought it and were devastated. Wake up, Pills! Our son! My relief at having sold the story was tempered by a new realization of just how appalled they would be to discover the truth. LSD is not addictive, but my experiences demonstrate just which intoxicants are most likely to play hell with your life if encountered at an impressionable age. Not long before the LSD incident, in that same family basement at 54 Clement Drive, I got drunk for the first time. It was that same 1971 Christmas break, and this time I was in the basement with Jock and my friend Bodo. With Jock's help, we had obtained a bottle of something called Kelowna Double Jack. It cost $1.05 and went equally badly with meat or fish. One moment I was sitting on the floor guzzling, the next I had somehow ended up flat on my back knocking over a set of chess pieces, laughing like a hyena. A pivotal moment, like a rat running his first maze. The time would come when alcohol would cause me a great many problems. But the path to delinquency wasn't that simple. There were other motivations. For a gangly kid entering junior high, getting into trouble could be a means of survival. Every kid on the brink of the adolescent abyss seeks a strategy for ensuring safety and rank. Those who lack physical strength and athletic prowess will often find themselves terrorized and humiliated. Social status offers protection, physical protection, where boys are concerned. You need to make alliances. Not long after we moved to 54 Clement, I began to feel a desperate need for protection. I made a friend in class. Reed, the son of an RCMP officer, lived a block away from us. He was a small kid with a shock of beetleish black hair and narrow, squinty eyes behind thick black-framed glasses. Somehow he managed to rock that look. For an unusually small boy, Reed was possessed of an eerie self-confidence. We bonded over music. He was a fanatic about identifying clues to the Paul is dead controversy, ranging from the obvious, Paul McCartney facing backward on the back of the Sgt. Pepper's cover, to the truly obscure, like a Canadian-only Beatles release called Very Together that featured a photo of four candles, one recently extinguished. We would sit in Reed's living room, pore over the clues, and try to get his turntable to run backward. Reed often spoke about his previous address on the east side of Brandon. It was a tougher neighborhood, with more famous thugs, in particular, Eddie Hoole. I once encountered Hoole's gang at a hockey game, practicing random terror on bystanders, then on me after I made the mistake of attempting a pleasantry. Suck-ups are to be punished. Eddie and his boys chased me to a bus stop and surrounded me. At the last moment, I was spared a beating when one of their gang turned out to be a schoolmate who vouched for me. But before the bus arrived, Eddie stepped close. "You think you're safe now?" he hissed. Then he kicked me three times hard and remarkably fast. Reed claimed he was pals with those guys. Anybody that messed with him would have to tangle with Eddie. Reed had plans of a criminal nature. He had spotted a potato chip truck that was habitually parked a few blocks away, and he wanted to break into it. That never came off, although it probably inspired another caper later that year that involved lying in wait for milk trucks. When the driver left the truck idling, we would open the back doors and steal plastic milk jugs, redeemable for 40 cents each. Our downfall? Redeeming the jugs at the same grocery store the truck had been idling behind. The second time we tried it, another milk truck swung in behind, blocking the lane. A sting! We were busted! My parents were horrified. Meanwhile, my biggest problems would come from a plan I didn't even join. Shortly after our family moved into 54 Clement, one of us kids made a weird discovery. Hidden in the rafters of the furnace room was a bottle of chloroform and a pile of new syringes. It lent credence to vague rumors about the eccentricity of the previous tenants. One of that family's teenagers had carried the nickname Rigor Mortis, a sort of goth girl before her time. What anyone would do with chloroform and syringes was, and still is, a mystery to me. But someone else had ideas. I showed the strange discovery to Reed and another school buddy named Daryl. Mistake. Reed's squinty eyes lit up. "Let's take this stuff out," he said, "and inject some cats." I liked cats. We had one. I voted no. Reed and Daryl voted yes, and took the chloroform and syringes with them. I was in a panic. One did not rat on friends, but this seemed to me beyond the pale. I told Mum. Parents were called, which in the case of Reed meant notifying the RCMP. Suddenly, I had two more enemies at school. One day, while out riding my bike, I found myself circled. Reed led the little biker group, swooping around on his little Mustang banana seat two-wheeler. "Come on, Steve," Reed sneered. "Don't be a chump." "Why'd you rat us out, Steve?" Darrell asked. "I'm going to put in a call to Eddie Hoole," Reed said. "You'll be dead." There was a protocol for after-school fighting. An actual fight, agreed upon by both parties, would happen only if the antagonists were roughly the same size and skill levels. Otherwise, violence was more a matter of bullying and intimidation. An alpha tough guy might decide to make your life hell, and hell it would become. I'd been in a few fights, it was inevitable. Generally, I did okay, since there wouldn't have been a fight if I was up against a real scrapper. It was strange, though. Even if I held my own, I would be scared of the other kid afterward. Fighting terrified me. It represented chaos. Anything could happen. I lacked instruction in self-defense. Dad certainly wasn't teaching me to fight, and there were no Karate Kid movies on TV, only the Three Stooges. Had I been a little more worldly, exposed to just a little bit of Eastern culture, I might have made something out of that influence. Perhaps some sort of hybrid stooge martial art. A crane stance, a mantis position, two fingers in the eye, a double ear pull, and a whoop 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 whoop. But I never attempted to hone any kind of fighting skill. Physical combat requires confidence. I was confident only in the potential for defeat and humiliation. Ordinarily, Reed and I might have been legitimate combatants. I was bigger, but with a complete lack of skill or coordination, which evened things out. Reed wasn't having any of that, though. He played Boss Tiny, whose commands are executed by henchmen. He carried off his kingpin act with a certain panache. Vincent Massey now seemed to me very hostile territory. I pleaded with my parents to take me out of Vincent Massey and send me back to J.R. Reed. They agreed reluctantly. It was only pushing the problem down the road. There was no grade 8 at J.R. Reed. The next year, it would be Massey again. My first day of grade 8, all the students were in the gym, being assigned to homerooms. I scanned the room nervously, looking for Reed. The B's came up early, and my homeroom assignment was made. Next, C. Suddenly, I was no longer worried about locating Reed. I had other problems. A familiar name had just been added to my homeroom. My new classmate shambled over to where I was standing and threw me a sideways grin. I knew him. His name was Al C. This looked like very big trouble. Al was a local legend. His fame as a thug had spread beyond his own elementary school, Earl Oxford, and reached my own. In one of those mysterious schoolyard grapevine reports, it had become common knowledge at J.R. Reed that Al was after me. "Saw your friend Al C. today," another student would joke. Why Al was after me was never articulated. As far as I could recall, we had never met. But we were used to those kind of mysteries. A guy like Al didn't need an excuse. He had it in for me, that's all. Everybody knew it. Now we were together. Not just the same grade, the same class. And not just Al, but his buddy Ron F., too. Grade 8 was going to be worse than I'd feared. But Al did not torment me. On the contrary. He seemed to be seeking me out, offering a mumbling sort of conversation as he slouched down the halls. It became clear that Al did not bear me any ill will. The old rumors had never been true. In fact, Al told me he had seen me around town and thought I looked pretty cool. Moreover, we found plenty of common ground. Al may have been tough, but he was no knuckle-dragger. He turned out to be highly intelligent, with a penchant for observation, a sense of the absurd, and a cynical sense of humor. We shared tastes and opinions. When Rolling Stone magazine said the new Rolling Stones album, Exile on Main Street, was a bad record, Al and I both knew they were full of shit, as they later admitted. Physically, we looked a matched set, both sporting the same shaggy, shoulder-length, dirty blonde hair. We were buddies. I never did find out whether Reed got in touch with his pal Eddie. That was no longer an issue. Was my new alliance cynical? An arrangement of convenience? Sure, friendship with Al had its practical side. It offered protection. But it didn't feel like a calculated move. Al and I seemed to click. Yet I was always aware of a fundamental difference between us. While I was a kid from an apple pie household, dipping my toe into delinquency, Al came by his inner turmoil honestly. His mom had died young, and his father had married a woman with a young son of her own. Al and his stepmom were not on good terms. Entering grade 8, he already had a long juvenile record and his very own probation officer. Sometimes when we got drunk, he wanted to beat me up, but only rarely. It was a small price to pay. Nobody messed with us. And if hanging with Al meant boozing and trouble, well, I was headed down that track anyway. The milk truck heist had been a start. It had been followed by a bust for shoplifting an Alice Cooper album, Killer, from Kmart. Dad had to attend juvenile court with me. Experts say it's important for families to do things together, but I think it's possible to overstate the benefits. Grade 8 marked a sharp break from my scholastic past. My marks sucked. I was a regular in the principal's office. As far as I was concerned, it was working out great. My fears of being bullied had not materialized. Rather, I was on the winning team. But once again, my stretch at Vincent Massey would be brief. This time, leaving wasn't my idea. I was never formally expelled. At a meeting called by Principal Henderson, it was strongly suggested to my parents that I be sent elsewhere for the good of all concerned. On my last day, I took the opportunity to plant a snowball between the shoulder blades of Mr. Haddad, my French teacher. He hauled me down to the office, but Henderson could only shrug. I'd expel him, but it was a free shot. They put me in a school located in another town. I began commuting 33 miles to school every day, hitching a ride with a teacher. But I was still hanging with Al and company on weekends. The level of transgression escalated. Al, Ron F., another young hoodlum, and I would be busted for a series of break-and-enters. There were busts for marijuana and liquor. My parents came to dread the sound of a telephone ringing after midnight. One day an RCMP officer came to the door asking questions about a drug raid the previous night. A hash pipe had been found in my buddy Gord's apartment. They could charge you with possession of cannabis just for the bits of resin caked inside the pipe. Gord had immediately ratted me out. Not as reprehensible as it sounds, he had already done time in jail for drug trafficking, and claiming ownership of that pipe would have sent him away again. For my mother, the immediate problem posed by the officer's visit was that my grandma was visiting at the time. Mum quietly asked if the officer would mind going around to the back door and sneaking into the basement, which he graciously agreed to do. I ended up charged with drug possession, but at least grandma never found out. The drinking escalated, too. By the time I reached grade 11, I was a confirmed problem drinker. Had I ever been found beaten to death in an alley, I could fairly have been described to the press as a figure known to police. Although I made the usual efforts to disguise my activities, it was clear to all that I was off the rails. My parents struggled to find the appropriate response. At one point, they threatened to send me to a strict private academy in Winnipeg. After I set another family first by failing grade 10 mathematics, I missed over 40 classes that year, they swallowed hard, abandoned their principles, and offered me a bribe. Noting my growing interest in photography, they offered to buy me an expensive camera should I pass grade 11 with a B average. It worked, but they still felt bad about it. They had never imagined it would be necessary to bribe their son to do something he should be doing for the sake of his own future. It wasn't often that something snapped, but it happened. One night my friends and I were playing cards in the basement. Mum had to work early the next day and had asked us to keep the noise down. We didn't. She came downstairs again and asked us to pack it in. I argued with her. I'm pretty sure I'd been drinking. Mum was reduced to tears. The card game continued. Next day I came home to find Dad standing in the dining room. "I am going to knock your teeth down your throat," he said. Dad was the kind of guy who couldn't even curse convincingly. Once or twice I heard him try to say, "fuck," and it just sounded wrong, like a suburban white kid trying to sound street. This was the first time I'd ever heard him threaten serious violence. To his credit, he sounded convincing. Without a word, I turned on my heel and headed right back out the door. A few friends took up a collection so I could spend the night in a motel. By the next day, tempers had cooled and we were both apologetic. Hardly a fair trade, apologetically speaking. Dad was the kind of Christian who would apologize to a lion for being chewy. My career as a juvenile delinquent was cruising along smoothly. Then, a tactical mistake. My 18th birthday. From now on, my crimes would be dealt with in adult court. And so it came to pass, very quickly. Chapter 12. Trials. Gavin was my best friend in high school. He was the son of a fellow United Church minister who was a good friend of Dad's. Gavin and I were sensitive souls who liked to drink beer under the stars, lying on the hood of his 55 Ford pickup, discussing Dostoevsky and girls. But when it came to the law, we were gleeful little cynics. Gavin and I were fully aware that maximum penalties for juvenile offenses topped out at $25 fines. Being under 18 was like having diplomatic immunity. All very well, until I had that one birthday too many. My adult criminal record began with a charge of carrying open liquor in public, laid at approximately 12:20 a.m. on August 26, 1976. A mere appetizer. One fall night, Al, Gavin, and I were at a local 7-Eleven after returning from a football game in Winnipeg. We were a little drunk, but by our own high standards, not particularly. Al started raising hell. He broke a bottle of salad dressing on the floor of the store and then added an overripe banana. I stole some tinned oysters. Police were summoned. Answering the call was Officer B, a cop with a history of aggressive policing. Al could be obnoxious, we all could. From my current vantage point, I might be inclined to punch my younger self in the throat. It's an idea that seems to have occurred to others as well. Officer B and his partner decided to tow Al's car. Al argued. The store manager had agreed to let him park the car there overnight. Al was standing by the squad car making his case. Officer B suddenly popped like an IED. Grabbing Al by his long, dirty blonde hair, Officer B jammed a knee into his abdomen and stuffed him into the squad car. Al thrust the car keys through the open window of the car. "Gavin," he called, "take the car and drive it away." Gavin took the keys and looked nervously at Officer B. "Any reason why I can't do that?" he asked. Officer B replied with a sweeping kick that took Gavin's legs out from under him. Slapping handcuffs on one of his wrists, he pulled the cuffs up while bringing his knee down on Gavin's chest. He stuffed Gavin into the back seat with Al and then came toward me. Another sweep kick and I was on the pavement. We were not the only ones caught off guard by Officer B's violent outburst. His partner also seemed at a bit of a loss. After I regained my feet, the other cop pushed me around a little bit. "Gonna keep causing trouble," he muttered, but there wasn't much conviction to it. His real goal, it seemed, was to distract me from Officer B's rampage. At last, the officers drove off with Al and Gavin. I was left standing in the parking lot. Gavin and Al were both charged and released. Later, filled with righteous outrage, Gavin and I recounted the sequence of events to our parents. We yelped about lawsuits. "You provoke them," Dad said. "You're putting yourself in those situations." Still, the police reaction disturbed them, and since I hadn't been arrested, what point could there have been in knocking me down? The same question apparently occurred to the police. 3 months after the incident, an official report was filed. The three of us, it claimed, had physically attacked the officers, who were then forced to defend themselves. I was now facing 5 charges, including assault of a police officer and obstruction of justice. Gavin and Al were juveniles. I testified for Gavin in juvenile court. Presiding judge dismissed my testimony as concocted. Gavin was convicted and assigned the usual modest fine and probation. Al left the country, thumbing his way south. My case was different. I was 18, an adult. A trial date was set. These were serious charges. If convicted, I was looking at potential jail time. The days of shoplifting Alice Cooper records now seemed like the innocent idylls of youth. A couple of months before the trial, I received a letter from Canada Customs and Immigration asking me to attend a meeting. At the appointed time, I was ushered into an office containing a desk and a bureaucrat He flipped through a file, while I sat still waiting to find out what was up. "You were born in Ohio, correct?" he asked. He continued to flip through the file. "Ah," he said, "I see here that your father exercised his right to bring you into the country as a Canadian citizen." And with that, our business was done. This meeting, it turned out, had been the commencement of a possible deportation proceeding. Someone in the police department or prosecutor's office had checked my birth certificate and informed immigration authorities that I was a potentially dangerous alien. Presumably, the plan was to drive me to the North Dakota border and dump me. It would have been a dicey situation. My initial 1.5 years in Ohio had not allowed much time for networking, and I certainly lacked contacts in Fargo or Bismarck. I could have built some sort of snow shelter close to the border where my folks could lob food to me across the line. I got to stay in the country. But these guys weren't fooling around. Perhaps not surprising, since the case boiled down to a we said they said. If our version was judged true, the police were officially liars. Among the most remarkable aspects of the story in hindsight is that my parents truly believed me. For years, I had been putting them through the ringer with drunkenness, truancy, and petty delinquency. But they knew me, and this time, they believed me. Or is that simply what parents do? Neil Entwistle's mum believed in him. Entwistle was a Brit living in Massachusetts. In January 2006, he shot his wife and baby daughter and immediately jumped on a flight to the UK, where police eventually found him at his parents' place in Nottinghamshire. He claimed to have been so overwhelmed at discovering his dead family that he simply had to flee the country. According to Entwistle's mum, her son is innocent. In the summer of 2009, Ryan Jenkins killed his ex-wife Jasmine in LA, then took off for BC, where he hanged himself in a motel room. His parents insist that Jenkins was innocent of the murder. Now I cringe every time some devoted mother pops up on the evening news proclaiming that her misunderstood son could never be guilty of murdering his wife, despite the video surveillance footage and "my husband did it" scrawled on the floor in the victim's own blood. I marvel anew at the parental capacity for self-delusion. At the time of my trial, I knew that my parents' belief in me would probably inspire that same brand of skepticism. Dave, one of Mum's co-workers at the community college, had some pals on the police force. He teased my mother for her faith in me. "My friends and I," Dave explained, "were lying little troublemakers." When she recounted the conversation later, Mum seethed. Perhaps more than anything else about the period, I remember her anger. After all I had done to Mum and Dad, how humbling. Was it parental blindness inspired by love? No, I really was innocent, of these charges at least, and my parents knew it. I think they knew I couldn't lie so convincingly, and sorely though I tested it, they had faith in me. My parents hired a good lawyer, and we prepared for our day in court. Just before the trial began, our lawyer sat us down and revealed that the prosecution had made an offer, in effect a guarantee that no penalty would be sought if I would admit guilt. My lawyer suggested I take a little walk and think before answering. Gavin and I took a stroll through the halls and talked, but there was not much question about it. We were young and filled with the fire of righteousness. I wanted to go ahead with the trial. My parents agreed. Into court we went. Pretty fascinating stuff, all in all. It was easy to get caught up in the process and forget that I was sitting at the defendant's table. The proceedings were not exactly the sort of legal jousting later glorified on Law and Order et al. At times, the trial resembled a political smear campaign more than a fact-finding exercise. Witnesses were called, including the cops, the store owner, and a few onlookers. I'm not sure my lawyer would have called Al even if he hadn't fled the country. Gavin didn't testify. At one point, a witness misidentified the kind of car we had been in, which was a green Volkswagen Fastback. I whispered to my lawyer and sat back to await the dramatic debunking. "Are you sure it wasn't a Volkswagen?" my lawyer asked. The witness insisted it had been a red Austin Mini. A telling mistake, the Mini belonged to a different friend of mine. My lawyer just shrugged. Dramatics may work for television, but a good lawyer doesn't smack the judge over the head. Eventually, my lawyer put me on the stand, where I described the events of the evening. Then, cross-examination. To the chagrin of my parents, my lawyer, and myself, I had recently handed the prosecutor a bit of extra ammunition. "Mr. Burgess," the prosecutor asked, "weren't you in court earlier this very week on a charge of drinking and driving?" I had been indeed. Racing to the store to get more beer before closing time, I was pulled over and flunked a breathalyzer. A guilty plea, a $250 fine, 6-month license suspension, and a rather inconvenient black mark on my reputation just in time for the big trial. 2 court appearances in a single week, a family record that would never be challenged. "Have you also been arrested for possession of marijuana?" he continued. "Also true," I allowed. "Are you an alcoholic?" he asked. "No," I insisted, "I am not." Possibly adding perjury to my growing list of crimes. He then wound up and delivered his final spitball. "Is it not true," he asked, "that last Tuesday afternoon, you and your friend Gavin were on Princess Avenue, drunk and disorderly, pointing and laughing at a mentally retarded Indian woman?" Stunned, I paused a moment. Just where had I been last Tuesday? Well, not there, anyway. My subsequent denial was thus emphatic and indignant. Passing the prosecutor's table, I paused. "You didn't see me do that," I protested. "I don't know," he said with a grin. "Was it you?" As my lawyer explained later, he just wanted the judge to see you thinking about it. The verdict, when it came, was oddly anticlimactic. Throughout the afternoon, the prosecution had attempted to paint me as having been stone drunk that night. In his closing arguments, my lawyer suggested that if so, I was not responsible for my actions. The judge agreed. "There will be an order of acquittal," the judge said. My lawyer turned to me and smiled. "Stay out of trouble," he said. I had been found not guilty, not because the judge believed my version of events, but because legally I was judged too drunk to know any better. Later, we heard from a friend of Dad's who also knew the judge. He suggested that the judge was more than familiar with the policing style of Officer B. Had he simply been looking for a legal hook upon which to hang my acquittal? My parents didn't care. I had dodged a bullet. We all understood that I'd been lucky, and as it turned out, that would be the end of my criminal career. But I wasn't out of the woods yet. I was still a drunk. By my early 20s, I had embarked upon a career as a disc jockey, spinning 45s in small Canadian towns. My drinking had taken me along that familiar curve from teenage party animal admired for his tremendous capacity, to teenage party animal inspiring a growing level of concern among friends, to 20-something guy drinking himself out of a job or two, to guy living alone in a strange city and regularly hauling home 42 beers in a backpack, enough for 2 solitary trips to Blotto Town. Every drunk has stories. Actor John Larroquette tells of emerging from a blackout to find he was on an airplane and trying to figure out through casual small talk just where it was he was going. I'm not really the best source for some of my own ugly tales. You'd have to talk to a participant whose personal think tank wasn't flooded at the time. But I remember the life and the feelings associated with it. There's a sort of a romantic fatalism that young people often embrace. No future, as the Sex Pistols sang. I wallowed in that, for lack of any other option. It did seem as though the future was something for which I would not be eligible. It's remarkable to consider the things one can be grateful for. My luckiest break may have been losing control of my bladder. After drinking myself senseless, I would often wake up soaked in my own urine. It wasn't pleasant. My penchant to view myself as a complex, self-destructive philosopher romantic was hard to maintain, the romantic part at least, when I was busy wetting myself like an untrained mongrel. My method of dealing with it may provide a perverse glimpse into the problem-solving techniques of an addict. Consider my options. A. Quit drinking. Or B. Prepare for each solitary drinking bout by stripping to my undies and then covering the entire apartment floor with newspapers, since there was no telling where I might eventually fall senseless and stain the hardwood. B it was. I could have sold tickets and made it into a lottery like Cow Patty Bingo. There were other disasters, many. If all the humiliation, degradation, and failure doesn't make one stop, what will? What epic piece of misadventure will finally be enough? A good question with no answer that I could see. As it turned out, drama wouldn't be necessary. I was parked in my favorite armchair in an Edmonton, Alberta basement suite. For the last few months, I'd been working the all-night shift for a local rock station. Overnight shifts were great for a drunk. Drink yourself silly the night before and you get plenty of recuperative time before having to go to work. On this occasion, I was drinking tequila. It wasn't going down so great, which happens sometimes. The clock hit midnight. It was now April 3rd, 1983, Easter Sunday. As I sat, my mind wandered around to a familiar theme, the possibility of quitting. I'd never made a serious attempt, afraid that in failure I might come to resemble those buffoons who sit in the bar every afternoon, loudly proclaiming that they are currently consuming their final beer. A couple of weeks earlier, I'd met a woman at a party. It had got me thinking of a potential romance. But how? Young women tend to frown on partners who piss themselves of an evening. Thus, even the most routine of happy scenarios ran into a barrier. Sobriety looked like a green pasture on the far side of an electrified prison fence. Still, I had long imagined that one day a magical state of readiness would arrive and I would free myself. On that Easter morning, I held this belief up to scrutiny. It was horseshit. The fabled day of readiness was like the horizon, perpetually receding as I approached. I had become one of those donkeys with a stick protruding from its halter from which a carrot dangles. The donkey goes forward, but that clever carrot always escapes. Sitting in a mustard-yellow armchair in a spare basement suite, I asked myself, "Are you ready to quit?" The honest answer was no, I did not feel ready. It led to another logical question. Will you ever be ready? Again, the answer was no. That lovely horizon would always recede. But this realization had a flip side. The understanding that I would never be more ready than I was on that day. If the right day was never coming, then one bad day was as good as any other. It was just a matter of choosing one. So, in my mustard-yellow armchair on Easter morning, I decided to quit drinking. Leaving the tequila bottle on the side table, I went to bed. In Dickens' A Christmas Carol, Scrooge awakes on Christmas morning, realizes he is still in this world rather than dead and unmourned, and breaks into a dance of giddy glee. It's a moment of pure joy. But it passes over a key decision, a moment crucial to Scrooge's transformation. What if Scrooge had awakened and, after a moment of confusion teetering between dream and reality, shaken off the spell and dismissed the entire vision as a fantastic nightmare? Habit and custom exert a tremendous pull. Even a sudden gift of revelation can pop like a soap bubble, leaving the recipient to take up the old familiar ways. Drunks have a reflex developed after countless embarrassments that causes a wave of revulsion to strike immediately at the point of regaining consciousness. "Oh my God," thinks the sodden brain, "what did I do last night?" It's as regular as the chimes of Big Ben, even on those occasions when it turns out you actually stayed home and watched Godzilla flicks until you keeled over. When I awoke late on that Easter morning, I did not break into Scrooge's happy dance. Instead, the reflex kicked in. What nonsense was I spouting last night? Instinctively, I prepared to repudiate the optimistic dreams of the night before. There had been no spirits, except the problematic kind. And it was those distilled spirits of Mexico that had filled my head with visions of a new life. It wouldn't be the first drunken fantasy I'd sobered up and forgotten. But standing under the shower, I let myself wonder. Suppose I'd meant it. All I really needed to do was take myself seriously. The idea began to take hold. Like many a radical notion, it was a simple one. I could change my life and my fate with a decision. Remarkably, the issue seemed uncertain for only a few days. A sense of elation and possibility was building, and the momentum seemed irresistible. Scrooge's dance would not be denied me, only delayed a little. A few days after Easter, I was pulling an overnight shift all alone in the quiet radio station. walking out of the studio to clear paper from the clattering newswire, I jumped into the air and slapped the arch of the doorway. I'd done it. I knew I would never drink again. I'd cleared the fence running. I was free. Nothing ever happened with that young woman. She was a deus ex machina, a cheap dramatic trick. She was like a giant meteor dropping in out of nowhere to erase the past, changing everything, and vanishing. Most important non-girlfriend ever. I waited 2 weeks before telling my parents. I wanted it to seem credible. The happiness and relief in Mum's voice were something I had often dreamed of hearing. I had given her a gift that was long overdue, and had there been any wavering in my resolve, it would have disappeared at that moment. But in fact, I had no doubts. I was finished with alcohol. It was gone like an amputated limb. Strange that I should be able to make the break so cleanly when others have struggled, people I've known before and since, who fight and backslide and try again, always battling. Why me? For that matter, why did I become a drunk in the first place? Circumstances certainly didn't set me up for social drinking. Manitoba winters are not cocktail parties. On the weekends, we juveniles who were bent on misadventure had to congregate outdoors, hiding from cops while staying out of the wind in clumps of bush or sheds, once even in the cabs of used combines on a farm implement dealership lot. Get as much alcohol into your belly as fast as possible before the cold becomes too much. Keeping the beer on ice was never a problem, at least. Our music spoke of a more sophisticated world. Van Morrison sang about his wild night. And all the girls walk by dressed up for each other, and the boys do the boogie-woogie on the corner of the street. Nobody wrote pop songs about Manitoba and trying to get drunk before your feet or your beer froze solid. Whatever legacy this social schedule may have left, it certainly inculcated the very worst of drinking habits. And yet, as far as I know, my young drinking buddies did not become problem drinkers en masse, just me. Why? As a drunk, I always suffered from a serious disadvantage. Many dipsomaniacs have horror stories to lean on when explaining their histories. They were abused, or poor, or coat-hangered for smiling, or made into unwilling surrogates for Mummy's failed Broadway ambitions. Not me. I had wonderful parents. In my parent-child relationship, the pain flowed pretty much in one direction. I'd kill to have some of the excuses other spongeheads can offer, but it was my curse to have had two loving guardians and a perfectly good upbringing. I had at least one glimpse of the other side. In 1973, I was just shy of my 15th birthday, hanging out with Al and getting into various types of mischief. My hair was draped over my shoulders, and inspired by A Clockwork Orange, I had taken to wearing a black bowler hat. I was puzzled that so many complete strangers wanted to beat me up. My parents allowed me to join Al's family on a trip to the West Coast. It would be my first visit. We went to Vancouver, Bowen Island, and up the coast to Vancouver Island to Campbell River. Although I would never have admitted it to myself at the time, I was somewhat awestruck. The citizens of Vancouver and the islands seemed impossibly cool, the weather so agreeably mild, the landscape so full of casual beauty. I resented all that. Al and I behaved badly, of course. In Campbell River, we pelted passersby with ice from our second-story hotel room. When the desk clerk phoned up to complain, I impersonated the deep voice of Al's father. "No, no," I intoned. "The boys have been right here with me all along." But I behaved badly in other ways, shameful ways. I became a profiteer in a family war. Al and his stepmother were barely civil. The default family dynamic was suppressed hostility. Stepmom, supported by Al's father and protective of her young son, was wary lest my presence tip the balance of power. So, she gave me money. Frequently. And I took it. I went shopping at Vancouver record stores, bought myself a Yes Close to the Edge t-shirt, and a glass hash pipe. Al was seething. "She's trying to buy you off," he would say. I shrugged and counted my war profits. But I would pay. Al occasionally took out his frustrations by pounding on me. Once when I was lying on a motel room bed, he picked up the mattress and launched it into the corner, me with it. I responded by setting off an entire book of matches, which frightened him into letting me out. Minor beatings were not the worst, though. The worst was the drive back. over 1,000 miles in a massive blue Buick, Al and I in back, the other three up front, a closed container with pressure building steadily. One day Al was teasing his little stepbrother, making him cry. Stepmom snapped. Turning toward the back seat and windmilling her arms at Al, she screamed, I hate you, you son of a bitch! Another day, with the Buick barreling along the highway at 70 miles per hour, Stepmom interrupted another screaming match to point a finger at the corner of the back seat where I was trying to shrink into the upholstery. Why is he always here when we fight? She shouted. Believe me, ma'am, I would much rather be strapped to the roof rack like a dead moose. Brandon. 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 The mantra repeated over and over and over in my head as the telephone poles crawled by, the blessed name tumbling and tumbling until the stuffing came out, losing cohesion and dissolving into meaningless syllables. I longed to be home. I had discovered the terror and strangeness of life outside the parental umbrella. Moreover, I had seen firsthand evidence that my delinquent buddy Al had good reason for acting out. I had no such justification. If I needed more evidence of my willful perversity, I needed only to compare my own upbringing with my mother's. There's always a tendency to mine one's personal history for justifications. Everybody has pain, but it's not that simple. My mother is proof. If an emotionally troubled childhood led to alcoholism, Mum would have been a booze hound and I would merely have been carrying on a family tradition. As it was, my parents never drank at all until I was in my teens. When they did start, it was a glass of wine at dinner or a single scotch. I never saw either one of them even get tipsy. Not for the last time, I would see my mother's example defeat the easy explanations. Why then? Impossible to know for sure, but I've come to believe it's mostly a matter of personality type. I'm an extremist. Over the years, I've seen the same powerful drive, the same obsessive impulse that made me a determined drunk, reappearing in more benign and even useful areas, such as a consuming interest in photography or travel. For good or ill, my approach tends toward the all or nothing. If I can't blame Mum and Dad for my drinking problem, perhaps I can thank them for the clean finality of its resolution. I'm pretty sure I know which side of the family provided the meat cleaver with which I separated a troubled past from a brighter future. She who had sat on dark cellar stairs years ago, unwilling to yield to a powerful force, forming resolutions that would shape and change her future, she passed on to me the weapon that I finally laid hands on. April 3rd, 1983, was the beginning. It was renewal and redemption. For a couple of years afterwards, I experienced something like the opposite of mild depression. I awoke every day thinking myself lucky to open my eyes with no evil to reflect on from the night before. I felt I was starting the race 50 yards down the track from the rest of the pack. And part of my incandescent little ball of personal joy was the frequent reminder that my parents were proud of me, that I had finally started the long process of payback for all the fear and worry. In years to come, we would spend all our Christmases together, happy times, heightened just a little by the unspoken pleasure of our changed circumstances. I knew that Mum was thrilled and happy. She made that clear. And yet she would never completely leave those days behind. Every so often, largely through my own thoughtlessness, I would see the proof. The awful truth is that the life of a young delinquent is mostly fun. You don't have to worry about paying rent. Your actions may cause you problems with the law, but juvenile penalties are light. As long as you're still at home, it's party time. Most of the stress is experienced by your parents, which is something young jerks don't seem to care much about at the time. Roxanne was another of my old drinking pals, one of the few from the old Bush crew with whom I had subsequently maintained a friendship. A successful massage therapist, she would sometimes stop by the house to say hello. Roxanne would eventually become one of the very few people I ever knew my mother to actively despise. I really don't know whether Rox was trying to upset my mother, or whether she just had an unconscious genius for pushing the biggest, reddest buttons. One day, when Mum was doing some yard work, Rox was passing by and stopped to reminisce. We used to have some pretty big parties in that basement. This was the party house, all right. What were you guys thinking? Your kids got away with murder. As my mother described the conversation to me, I saw her as angry as I can ever recall. And it wasn't that Mum thought Rox was being unfair in her assessment. Mum agreed with her. Rox was like the thief who takes advantage of your unlocked door and then returns to crap on your rug. For the rest of Mum's life, my teenage troubles left her convinced she had been a failure as a guardian. I don't know what my parents could have done. 5 kids in 6 years with all the resultant issues to be juggled, plus 2 careers and at least 1 seriously rogue element dragging them into uncharted legal territory. What to do? Would that private school offering quasi-military discipline have helped? Who knows? I'm glad they didn't follow through on that. But I know Mum wrestled with those decisions. I know she never stopped. Once, at a family reunion, I made the mistake of reminiscing about some youthful criminal episode accomplished with my pals. Mum abruptly left the room. Even years later, in the apartment at River Heights Terrace, after I discovered that one of the home care nurses had been a high school classmate of mine, and we started talking about teenage hijinks, we were interrupted by Mum's whispery voice. "Could you change the subject?" she said. "It upsets me." She was in her 80s by then, more than 3 decades removed from the events in question. Carefree delinquency is no victimless crime.